coping with anxiety and stress during the pandemic. As the COVID-19 pandemic stretches on and on, most of us have dealt with a roller coaster of emotions, from fearfulness to dread, anger to sadness. And for many, all of it has been exacerbated by sleepless nights or loneliness. For some, the emotions are manageable, at least most of the time. But for many, the pandemic's effects have been overwhelming. A recent survey shows that 90% of Americans have been affected mentally by the pandemic. I'm Jennifer Rooks. What have you been doing to cope with the mental toll of the past few months? Are you searching for help during this difficult time? Our guest today will provide tips on coping with the pandemic and also resources available in Maine. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. For Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. If there is one thing people have in common during this pandemic, it is a feeling of stress and anxiety. Today, we'll discuss COVID-19's effects on mental health, ranging from a generalized sense of worry to more serious anxiety and depression. And we'll hear about some ways to cope. Joining me, Allegra Hirsch Wright. She is a clinical social worker with Maine Behavioral Healthcare. And Jenna Maynard is executive director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. As always, we want to hear from you. Has anxiety during this pandemic affected your daily life? Have you found any ways to reduce stress? Are you concerned about someone who is showing signs of depression? You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org. A brief email, please. Tweet at Maine Calling. Post a comment to our Facebook page or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. 1-800-399-3566. Jenna, a study I saw recently showed a survey where 90% of Americans are dealing with frustration, worry, and stress during the pandemic. Many others saying there's a rise in anxiety, depression, even suicides. What are you seeing?
I'm seeing all of those things. I think that's unfortunately the case, from people really struggling with anxiety about the uncertainty of the situation, about concern about the safety of their loved ones and themselves and what they can do during the pandemic, as well as, you know, we work closely with law enforcement who participate in the crisis intervention team program, and we've had three different departments tell us about three different suicide deaths in which the notes actually included comments about the pandemic and the lack of the ability to access resources during this time as the reason they decided to take their own life. So I think that this pandemic is having a significant impact on people's mental well-being, and really we all need to be mindful about what we can do about that.
Allegra, tell us about some of the reasons why. I mean, one would say if one is quarantining, obviously the loneliness, but there's even more going on here, right? What is it about human nature, the human brain, and then this pandemic that just makes everything worse?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of things. I think the first thing is that as humans, we really like to have control. And when we don't have control, that increases our anxiety, which can also increase, sort of various other mental health sort of struggles that we may be experiencing. I think the other piece is that, you know, sort of when all this initially happened, there was a lot of talk about social distancing. And I think a lot of people took that really literally and really isolated themselves. And I think more and more having the conversation around physical distancing versus social isolation is really different. And how can we keep ourselves physically safe while also still connecting, recognizing that that another thing that our brain really likes is that human connection. We're actually wired for connection.
Is part of it touch, that we're wired also for touch?
It is for a lot of people. I think that there's certainly a lot that happens in words when we talk back and forth to each other. But there's also a lot that happens just in body language and in touch and just sitting with somebody or being near somebody. And the fact that we're not able to necessarily do that, even though we can see maybe somebody's face on a screen, that is different than being in the same room as somebody. And then, as you said, being able to get a hug or even just a pat on the back from somebody.
And Jenna, there are also some real practical reasons, right? I mean, people might be worried about their finances because they've been laid off from their job. People may be worried about a loved one who is in a high-risk profession.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the challenge with the situation is there are a lot of things to be concerned about, whether that's your family's economic status or health status. And the uncertainty, you know, as just mentioned, is really challenging for the human brain to not be able to kind of plan out a course of action and have any control over that. So all of the concern that people are experiencing is completely normal. And I think that's the first thing for everyone to kind of take a deep breath and say, you know, I know everyone keeps saying we're in this together, but what we're experiencing right now is something that we've never experienced, most of us, right? And so how do we collectively give ourselves permission to navigate this and figure out how to manage the weight that comes with it? Because there is a lot of serious issues that are surrounding this situation, and there is that uncertainty. And all of that is just a lot. And saying, yeah, this is just a lot is completely acceptable. And so often people think, got to figure it out, got to keep going, got to make this all make sense. And that's a lot to put on yourselves right now.
Is that, Jenna, helpful? I mean, have there been studies that show by allowing yourself to accept that this is not normal, everyone's in it together, and we don't have all the answers, is helpful?
Yeah, because when we think about anxiety, right, there's a lot we can do for anxiety. And one of the first kind of coping mechanisms is to say to yourself, when the world's spiraling around you, what do I have control over? What do I have the ability to take action on? Because if you're worried about everything that's happening in these very unsettling times, then you're just going to spiral out because there's so much there, right? So I can wear a mask. I can be mindful of things. I can wash my hands. What can you do things about? Because unfortunately, there's a lot of things people can't, effectuate change over. They can't make a vaccine appear. They can't make it just go away. So kind of trying to create some sense of order about what can you control, what actions can you take, and accepting that you can't control it all is a way to kind of center yourself around some real actionable steps that then can make you feel like you have control over what you can actually control to help manage that anxiety.
Right. And Allegra, I'm thinking about sleepless nights. I know everyone I know is having more of them. And often when you're up in the middle of the night and your mind is racing, you can say to yourself, well, in the morning, it's all going to feel different. But that's mm-hmm. different now. Sometimes in the morning, it does not feel different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's so true. And I think, I think there's a couple of things that we can sort of do with that. I think first is reminding ourselves that while everything may not be different, there could be one thing that may be different. So it's similar to what was just being said around figuring out what you can control. It's sort of like breaking this really large problem into smaller bits. So looking at what might be different in the morning. The other thing that can really help, and I found this really helps with anxiety, is a lot of what wakes us up in the middle of the night is those worry thoughts, and we tend to then sort of go down those rabbit holes. And I've found that having a piece of paper and a pen by the bed to just be able to write down and get out of my head, then I feel like I have control over not losing my thought, and I can go back to sleep knowing that I can come back to that thought in the morning.
Right. Interesting. I read somewhere, I want to hear what you think about this idea, Allegra, that we can control what we dream about by telling us ourselves before we go to bed. I want to dream about that vacation I went on. I want to dream about my wedding day. I want to dream about swimming in the ocean. Do you think that that's advisable?
Yeah, so I think that's interesting. I think absolutely putting yourself in a positive mindset before you're going to sleep can only prove to be beneficial. I don't know the specific research around being able to control your dreams, but I think we've all had that experience where if we watch something that sort of feels particularly scary or stressful to us before we go to bed, that sometimes increases our chances of having scary dreams or nightmares. And so I think the same thing is true, that if we can put ourselves into this positive mindset and put ourselves maybe even specifically in this place that we really enjoy, like you said, dreaming of ourselves at the beach, then I think that can only increase our chances of having pleasant dreams or at least having restful sleep.
Jenna, what are some of the signs that you might be suffering from anxiety that might be more than everyday worry or concern during this time?
Well, I think the sleep that you started with is a really important one, right? Because our body, our brains, and we need sleep. And so when we are struggling with anxiety, often sleep is a significant challenge. Also, folks can experience a host of, you know, things like racing thoughts. They're having, you know, having a harder time managing their breath, wringing their hands, the sense that sort of the world is, things need to happen, and, you know, kind of this bopping around from things just going really fast, or just I encounter lots of folks with anxiety who just feel so overwhelmed, they kind of are just sitting there feeling paralyzed from taking action. And so I think everybody, you know, experiences anxiety a little differently, but the question to ask yourself is, are you feeling really overwhelmed, really anxious, concerned, worried, beyond in a way that's new for you? And how then can you start to unpack where that's coming from and what you can do about it? And I know, I just thinking about the people that I talk to, I have a 14-year-old in my life who's so worried about all of this that they are just constantly trying to measure out that they're 6 feet away from people, that everybody has a mask on, just this constant fear about the situation.
Mm. And I want to ask you, Allegra, Jenna mentioned a 14-year-old in your life. You specialize in children. Give us some tips on helping children cope with this.
Yeah, so I think the first thing is to be able to recognize sort of what's going on with our kids, and what we know about kids is that they really act out what they're feeling in their behaviors. So I think it's first being able to identify, are the behaviors that you're seeing in your child, if they're worrying you, are they new behaviors, are they increasing, and sort of getting a feel for, is this sort of typical, maybe they're just tired, or could this be something related to, related to the pandemic. I think then it's about naming it for your child and validating it, and so certainly in age-appropriate language, being able to tell your child that it's normal and typical that you're experiencing these feelings. You may be feeling worried or anxious. Sometimes I feel that way too, and here's what I do about it. And then be able to share and sometimes even practice a strategy with them so that they have something and a tool that they feel like they can utilize to manage that anxiety or that worry when it comes up.
Mm-hmm. If you'd like to join our conversation talking about anxiety and depression during COVID-19, our phone number 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email address to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. Jenna, how does one know when you need help? When the anxiety is beyond breathing deeply, exercising, trying to eat right, and get enough sleep?
Well, I think that's the first thing. You've made some really critical points there, is that, are you doing those things? Like, are you working to try to do the things that can promote your own mental well-being? And then, is your life being, negatively impacted? Because we all experience anxiety, but anxiety to the point that it is having an impact on your willingness and ability to engage in your life, even if our life is altered, still willingness to engage. And then it is time to figure out what is going to be meaningful and accessible to you as an individual. And more and more folks are engaging in teletherapy. It's hard to navigate, even when folks realize now they need help, it's hard to navigate that given that our mental health system in Maine is already very challenged. And now even accessing help is more challenging. But figuring out, is this something that's having such a detrimental impact on my well-being? And I will just point out that from an anxiety point, what research tells us is that someone who experiences significant anxiety over a prolonged period of time, that can have a direct causational relationship with the development of depression. So an anxious brain can become a depressed brain. And so it's why so often we see people co-occurring having both anxiety and depression diagnoses. So addressing anxiety is really an important thing for your mental well-being, and how to do that really varies on who you are and what you feel comfortable doing. And I know you said that are you eating your vegetables and all those things, but so often folks want to address their mental health and they somehow want to just feel better without recognizing that our brain is part of our body and it is an organ, and we do need to take care of it mindfully about how we feed it, how we sleep. Do we engage in some exercise? Are we drinking enough water? That might sound like I'm trivializing anxiety or depression. Absolutely not, but I'm not. But without those things, there's no magic pill that just makes anxiety disappear or depression disappear. It really does take intentional actions and then seeking help therapists who can engage in something like cognitive behavioral therapy to help you think through anxiety. But also, I'm just going to really state, when it comes to anxiety, yoga and meditation, while some of us are not necessarily wired to love those things, it took me a long time to incorporate them in my own routine, they're really impactful for anxiety.
I'm so glad you said that, and I wanted to ask you about that as well, Allegra. And I loved, Jenna, that you used the word trivialize, because I think if someone is in a really dark place and you start making suggestions, that often it doesn't seem sincere, it doesn't seem like enough. But Allegra, I want to ask you about that. Breathing exercises, meditation, big impact, right?
Huge impact, absolutely huge impact. You know, one of the things that those kinds of things do, the breathing, the meditation, yoga, tai chi, they're all really mindful movements of our body. And one of the things that we know is that when we're experiencing anxiety or other mental health challenges is that moving your body is so incredibly important, and being able to quiet the mind. And for somebody specifically who's experiencing anxiety, that's really particularly challenging to do. So to be able to learn different strategies and skills that can help yourself quiet your mind, even just for a moment, can really bring along great benefits.
Jenna, you mentioned a lack of mental health care in Maine. It's been an issue you and I have talked about on this program before. Given that, though, there are options for people. If someone is finding themselves in a little bit of a scary place, where would you recommend they call right now?
Well, there's a few different answers to that. First of all, if they're in a really scary place, they need to call the statewide crisis line and engage with a crisis provider. However, most folks, crisis, I always say the NAMI's role is to be the grout between the tiles, with the formal system being the tiles and us just kind of filling in the gaps to help people find the right tile. And so if folks are not sure how to find care or what would be the right type of care for them, we are funded by the state for a helpline, 622-5767, which our calls average about 20 minutes, helping people understand the mental health system, understand, how to find a private therapist versus an agency, and to really develop some understanding of that. So I think, saying, oh, you should just go to a therapist, we get tons of calls why, I think I know to go to a therapist. How do you find one of those? And so helping people to understand that process and to be able to, we call it therapist shop, because they're a great therapist for me could be a horrible therapist for you. Doesn't mean they're a bad therapist, just means they're not the right fit. So that's one important thing, is understanding that that the state does pay for, a helpline solely to help people navigate finding care. And also, we talked a little about young people. We did, we did start a teen text line, which exists solely to help 14 to 20-year-olds figure out kind of what they can do for themselves and how do they connect then to the formal mental health system. We've had people say, I think I need a therapist. I don't know how to bring it up with my parents. And, the college-age youth who work that help people come up with, how would you discuss that with your parent? How would you say, this is what I'd like to do? Because, I broke my leg. I need to go to the doctor. We're all pretty comfortable with that. How to ask to go to a therapist, depending on what kind of, household dynamic there is around mental health, is actually a pretty significant step. And then how to even find where you're going is also a significant step. But those of us in the mental health world forget, the rest of the world doesn't, if you're not connected to this world, you don't necessarily have any idea how to navigate it. So making sure there's bridges for people is really important.
What is the number for the teen text line?
It's 515-8398, obviously 207.
Wonderful. On that note, we are going to take a quick break. If you'd like to join the conversation, if you have questions for our experts, you can call 1-800-399-3566. You can send a tweet at Maine Calling, post a brief comment to our Facebook page, or send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Richard Parks Furniture, Ellsworth, committed to bringing the finest in classic and contemporary home furnishings to Maine. More at richardparks.com. And Maine Coast Heritage Trust, celebrating 50 years of land conservation leadership. Join today at mcht.org.
Country artist Margot Price says the creation of her new album was a lot like having a baby.
I think they're both kind of mysterious, and you kind of keep it to yourself at first, and it's like It's evolving and growing and changing.
Price reflects on motherhood, quarantine, and her rise to country fame. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon between 4 and 6:30 right here on Maine Public Radio. Tomorrow is primary day here in Maine. Our Your Vote 2020 debates, both the Democratic Senate primary debate and the Republican 2nd District House primary debate, are available for viewing anytime at mainepublic.org. Just click on the homepage Your Vote 2020 box. In addition, Maine Public Television will rebroadcast both debates tonight at 8 for the Senate primary debate and at 9 for the House primary debate. And again, they are both available anytime at mainepublic.org.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today's topic, dealing with anxiety and depression due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Joining me, Allegra Hirsch Wright with Maine Behavioral Healthcare and Jenna Maynard with NAMI Maine. You can join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll go to AMK, who's calling from Westbrook. Hi, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to share with the audience that I'm a caregiver for a senior parent, and I came across a program called the Caregiver Action Network, the national support program, and they have offered, I just went through a 90-day program where I had a weekly call with a counselor, but they also have a toll-free number for people to call, and if it's okay, I can share that with you.
Go ahead.
Online right now. It's 855-976-4277, and they have counselors available Monday through Friday from 7 a.m. to 6 p.m. Central Time. And again, that's a free service for people to call. It's typically revolves around folks that are caring for a parent, but they are a great resource in general for people who are needing help that are under an enormous amount of anxiety.
AMK, thanks so much for that recommendation. And Jenna, this is, we've talked about different groups that might be experiencing the anxiety in different ways. People caring for someone who is in a high-risk population would be among those.
Absolutely. People caring for people who are in a high-risk population, as well as those individuals themselves, are going to have a different level of worry or concern because the fact that the impact of COVID in their life has the potential to be much more likely to be fatal. And so I think that that's an awareness. And I think it also depends on, too, you think about folks who are elderly who may have dementia who are not necessarily grasping what's going on and therefore not necessarily taking the same precautions. There are, you know, I think that's a really important population to identify. Same with family members of our doctors and nurses and firemen and law enforcement who are going out into communities. They don't have control over who they're exposed to, either coming into the hospital or out on their job. And so recognizing that, I know lots of folks who have bought as much Lysol as they could possibly get their hands on just out of concern and worry.
Jen on Facebook writes, my 13-year-old has struggled with mental health, anxiety, and depression for years. COVID has really affected him hard. He's afraid that the virus is in the air. He had anxiety over Zoom and video calls. He misses his peers. He has submerged himself in video games to the exclusion of anything else. He gets angry, rude, and disrespectful easily. He is eating and sleeping much less. I'm a single mom, and I'm still working full-time from home, which also makes him jealous that I, quote, get to be on the computer. It's work. And he refuses to take any of my coping skills suggestions. Is this just preteen angst? What can be done? Allegra.
Yeah, so I think, you know, certainly without knowing, more about the situation, it certainly seems like that there may be some benefit to some additional conversations and maybe additional support. So I think, you know, I think we all sort of know that teens can certainly be filled with angst. And I think especially, during this time when we know that teens are so connected socially with each other and that's so incredibly important to them, that to be in isolation isolation can be really challenging. I think, you know, because there was the identification that there was anxiety and depression experienced before COVID, I think this is probably an additional impact onto that. And, you know, so I think continuing to support the child, I think, you know, the other thing that happens, and this is true with teenagers specifically, is that it's really hard for teenagers to receive information from or get help from their parents. You know, we all went through that stage where we thought our parents had no idea what they were talking about, and that doesn't change just because of a pandemic. So it might also help to sort of think about, is there a family friend that this teenager really connects to, or another adult, maybe a teacher or a coach or somebody, another adult that this child really connects to be able to maybe have that adult offer some support and some strategies.
All right. An email here from Mike. My wife and I are in our early 70s. We're blessed to be in good health and able to afford living expenses. But the fear, anxiety, and outrage I feel is directly related to a president named Donald Trump and the catastrophic influence he has on our collective welfare. And Jenna, whether it's the president you're stressed about, whether you're involved in the Black Lives Matter movement, whether you're looking at the wars around the world, I mean, COVID-19 is not happening in a vacuum. There are other really stressful things happening in our world right now. How do we, again, untangle some of this valid concern and still take care of ourselves?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. There's just a lot going on, and it can be amazingly stressful or overwhelming. And that's where I go back to, what can I do to impact something that matters to me today? And how do I, you know, sort of recognize that I can't impact all of those things, the individual who's very frustrated with the president. So what can they do? They can obviously vote for somebody else. But the concept of all of this going around and the chaos, trying to find order and what you can actually control and what you can actually do something about is really important, because if we get kind of wound up in the tsunami of all of this unrest, it's just going to continue to overwhelm our mental well-being. And then we go from having anxiety to potentially developing depression. And then it becomes, you know, then I worry about the fears or the feelings of hopelessness, because being hopeless or feeling hopeless is one of the significant red flags for concerns about suicide. And, you know, we do lose a minor to suicide every 36 hours before the pandemic. And so I think that it's really important that we try to find the calm in that storm, however we're able to do that, whether that's engaging with a professional, whether that's engaging with more family or engaging in more self-help or all of those things. But prioritizing our mental well-being is critical right now.
I want to ask you, Allegra, about people who had mental health issues before COVID. How is the onset of the COVID crisis affecting them differently?
So I think it's really just that it's that additional impact. You know, it sort of has this snowball effect. So, you know, when you start off with a smaller snowball and then it snows more and you sort of create that bigger snowball, I think that's what's going on. So somebody who maybe struggled with anxiety before COVID hit, then now there's all these additional things that they feel like they don't have control over or that they're worried about or feeling anxious about. So I think, again, it's about sort of as Jenna just put, again, looking at what are the little things that we have control over, and sort of how can we break down what feels like this very large problem into small little bits so that I can look at those small little bits and figure out, what do I have control over? What do I maybe have a little bit of influence over but can't control completely? And what can I not control at all? And then how can I focus my energy on the things I can control and maybe influence?
Well,
and Jennifer, if I could
go ahead, Jenna.
Touch on that too. I think it's also important to recognize that, and you know, NAMI is a part of the Maine Association of Family Organizations with GEAR and Maine Parent Federation and the Autism Society. So when we think about people who are already impacted before the pandemic pretty significantly by mental health challenges, what we know is that the acuity of their challenges has pretty significantly increased, whether that's, you know, from our contact with law enforcement telling us the calls are definitely more acute, or what they're finding at scenes of suicide, or talking to families that responded to a survey who have kids with mental health challenges, you know, really highlighting, and it's a perfect way to highlight some of this challenge, that if you have a child with autism and some other mental health related things. And at school, they had a school social worker, they had an OT and a speech therapist, and they had a variety of service providers in their life. And then at home, they had the Section 28 provider, and they had a therapist. And all of that stopped. I mean, Section 28 services weren't coming into homes. Most of the time, law enforcement was responding because crisis wasn't feeling safe to do so. So you just go from people who had a network of support, and those networks are starting, you know, they've started to come back, obviously, you know, in the months of June and July. But for a while there, they were not there. And so we know, you know, we have 900 families enrolled in the Family Respite Program. 75% of those families have kids with a mental health diagnosis. And they were like, please tell us we can still get respite, and that we were able to do that safely. But when you already have a significant mental health issue and you have a support team, you're used to being able to rely on them. And, you know, we've gotten through the other side, and we're trying to make sure that teletherapy has, you know, has all of the necessary kind of blessings and regulations it needs to continue, trying to get the federal government to fund the HEROES Act, to fund community-based mental health services, to keep them afloat when some of them are really struggling through this. But there was definitely a time where folks who were already significantly impacted by their mental illness felt very abandoned by their services. And so we need to make sure we get those services back out into communities and back connected to the people that need them desperately. But we definitely saw, I mean, we operate one of the state-funded peer centers, and we definitely experienced ourselves the level of acuity really increasing, and the existing resources to wrap around them during the height of the lockdown really decreasing significantly. So getting people back to services is a really important thing for folks who live with significant mental health challenges.
We'll go to Sue, who's calling from Belgrade. Hi, Sue. Go ahead.
Hi. Coming home from Belgrade after visiting my daughter and grandchildren, and at one point her daughter was acting out, and my daughter had said to me she's acting out a lot lately. And in listening to your conversations and the anxiety and the anxiousness of young children, she has made a simulated play area downstairs where she has blue tape every 6 feet apart. And before entering the room, there's a sign that says, if you need help, come see me. And so just in listening to this conversation, when do we recognize that it's not cute, it's cute, it's scary, it's a message.
Allegra?
Yeah, so I think it definitely is a message. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, kids share how they're feeling through their behaviors, and that also includes their play. So we can learn a lot about what is sort of going on or what may be going on in a child's head by watching their behaviors and by watching their play. So I think, you know, I think certainly maybe having some, you know, and again, sort of age-appropriate conversations. So maybe sort of just asking this child about what it is that they're building or what the tape means, or sort of just an open-ended kind of a question that can get them talking. And then also, as I talked about before, really validating their feelings and letting them know that as adults we also are experiencing some of these worries. And again, sort of reminding them of what are some of the strategies that they have, including knowing that they can come talk to you as the adult and share, you know, anything about how they're feeling, and that you're going to help them figure out how to manage that feeling. But I think certainly recognizing that in their play and in behaviors, you know, one of the things that happens, especially for younger kids, is we oftentimes see a regression in their behaviors. So things like not wanting to sleep alone in their own bed anymore, maybe a regression in toileting behaviors, talking in a baby voice, being extra clingy. And so we definitely see that in kids. And so really it's about being able to really just sort of put it out there and ask them, you know, sort of what's going on, how they're feeling, maybe point it out, sort of say something like, I see you doing this. I wonder if you're feeling scared. I wonder if you're feeling worried. Can you tell me more about that?
Sue, thanks for your call and good luck to you and your family. We're going to go to Joanne calling from Harrison. Hi, Joanne. Go ahead.
Hi. I wanted to thank you, Allegra, for highlighting the link between physical well-being and psychological well-being. Also, I wanted to put in a plug for prayer in terms of offering hope. I think that can sometimes be very effective. But lastly, I wanted to bring up the fact that we really have no life experience similar to our parents. My dad was older when I was born, and he grew up in grade school during World War One. Came of age during World War Two. That was 6 years. My parents developed this resilience and stamina that I don't have. And I think, you know, they were in it for 6 years. We've only been in the pandemic 6 months. And I think that's part of it. We haven't learned that life experience.
Interesting point, Allegra.
Yeah, so I think it's certainly really helpful to think about resilience. You know, I think that's really, I think that's actually one of the most important things to think about, to recognize that, you know, that what we're experiencing is certainly, certainly stressful, and for a lot of folks is feeling very traumatic, and that's really typical, and we would expect that, and that even though this experience is certainly impacting all of us, it doesn't necessarily mean that we're all going to walk out of this traumatized. And so I think it's about remembering that we are all resilient. We're actually we're born with biological traits that increase our resilience, and then there's also external factors throughout our lives that strengthen our resilience. And so being able to recognize that and remember that we are resilient doesn't, you know, certainly you don't want that to mean so then sort of just buck up because we'll get through it. But it can be helpful, especially when you start to feel yourself, or if you recognize that somebody you care about is going to that place of hopelessness, really being able to connect to that resilience piece can be really helpful.
Joanne, thanks for your call. We are going to take another quick break. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from the Maine Office of Tourism, encouraging you to get back out there and gain a whole new appreciation for Maine by returning to favorite spots and discovering new ones, and exploring everything that makes Maine uniquely Maine. The jagged mountains and rolling rivers are calling. The secluded trails and abundant forests are calling, just like they have been for over two centuries. Revisit and reconnect with the places Mainers call home. For inspiration and itineraries, go to visitmaine.com.
On This Day in Maine's History is brought to you in partnership with the Maine Historical Society.
Inventor Francis Edgar Stanley died on July 13, 1918. He and his twin brother, Freeland Oscar Stanley, were the inventors and manufacturers of the Stanley Steam Automobile. Born in Kingfield in 1849, Francis taught school before turning his talents to portraiture. He opened a portrait studio in Auburn in 1875 as a crayon artist. He began using photography in his studio in 1877 and opened studios in Lewiston, Auburn, and Bridgeton. He soon invented his own photographic dry plate formula and began manufacturing and selling his plates to other photographers in 1883.
On This Day in Maine's History is made possible through the generous support of Thomaston Place Auction Galleries and Maine Maritime Museum. Happy birthday, Maine!
The Daily Maine CDC briefing on the coronavirus has now gone to a regular twice-a-week schedule on Tuesdays and Thursdays. On those 2 days, it will normally happen at 2 o'clock. Maine Public Radio, Maine Public Television, MainePublic.org, and the Maine Public Facebook page will all bring it to you live. In addition, the briefings are archived at MainePublic.org for later on-demand viewing or listening. Just choose the television drop-down. Again, Maine's CDC briefing with Dr. Shaw and others is now normally scheduled for 2 o'clock on just Tuesdays and Thursdays each week, and carried here on Maine Public Radio, as well as Maine Public Television, MainePublic.org, and the Maine Public Facebook page.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today's topic, dealing with anxiety and depression due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Joining me, Allegra Hirsch-Wright. She's with Maine Behavioral Healthcare, and Jenna Mayner with NAMI Maine. You can join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Going to Marty, who's calling from South Portland. Hi, Marty. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. What a wonderful program, and very timely. Reason I called, I have a history of mental illness, depression, and thankfully with treatment and medication, I was able to come around and no longer on medication. And thank goodness for CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, and I practice those things. And as much as that all helps, I'm older and I live alone. And to put it bluntly, I've had no physical contact with a human being for months. Mm. I'm sure I'm not the only one.
Oh, I'm sure you're not.
So how can people in that situation do something about it? Phone calls, Zoom meetings, I'm in recovery, and that helps a lot too, having a higher power. But there's no replacing the physical contact. So what do you suggest?
Yeah, Jenna.
Yeah, I think that it is really important to be able to be connected to other people and important to be able to see other people and figuring out, you know, I have a large family that I hadn't seen, and my parents are elderly, and I hadn't seen them during the height of the lockdown. And finally, we all just self-quarantined, and I have a brother who lives in Jersey. We made him get a COVID test. But then we all just got together at my parents' house in the woods because we decided that the impact of not being able to see each other was just too great, but we needed to take appropriate safety. So figuring out, is there someone, whether it's a friend from, you know, a meeting or someone, you know, someone in your life for whom you would trust that they were being cautious, and then deciding that, you know, we all need to be mindful, but that doesn't mean we just stop living our lives and we don't see the people that are most important to us, you know, and being able to do that in a safe way. But, you know, my parents are 84 and 86. There's no way I'm not seeing them during this because I don't know how long they'll be here. And the thought of missing the time with them just isn't realistic. And so how do I do that? Make sure they're safe, make sure I'm safe, quarantining, testing, whatever. And then, you know, making sure you still have the ability to have human touch, hugs from the people most important to you in a mindful, intentional way, because I think that's really important right now.
Allegra, do you have anything to add to that?
I think the only thing I would add is just really how important that is, especially recognizing that we don't really know when the end is in sight. I think it might feel a little bit easier if we knew that in like 2 weeks, everything would go back to normal. But since we really don't know that, I think it's really about balancing your own specific needs and what's really going to support your mental health and really help improve your mental health during this time and how to do that in a safe way.
Marty, good luck to you, and thank you so much for calling and speaking for, I'm sure, so many people. We'll move on now. We'll go to Peter, who's calling from Belfast Harbor. Hi, Peter.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I think that in this time, with all the anxiety and depression and uncertainty, one of the important things is just to make a mental checklist. And on that list, seek out, you know, the places that calm you, places that you go to just reflect on life and, you know, bring those back into your life. That's, you know, kind of what I've been doing. I take longer walks and I list places I like to go to. Belfast Harbor is one of my more popular spots, you know. At the same time, I was in the Hampton Hills State Park and went for a nice hike up the mountain earlier. But very important to me is, you know, normally I would get by with a certain rationing of exercise. And in this time, you know, I try to, you know, not really push one session, but rather stretch it out into two. A morning activity and an afternoon activity, whether it's biking and walking, hiking, you know, climbing, you know, all those things. But it's very important that you can get your mind into a groove and a place that you just happen to feel is the right place for you, you know?
Yeah, and Allegra, I want to speak about that. We're lucky, aren't we, that this is summer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we are lucky. And, you know, I think being able to really focus on that and the benefits of that, I think, as well as the additional piece of that, we live in a really beautiful state, and we live in a state where for a lot of us, we can get out, and it doesn't necessarily mean that it needs means it's going to need a long car ride or take a lot of money. And so I definitely agree that getting outside, there's a lot of research about the benefits of nature and sunlight and fresh air. as well as the benefits of moving your body. In addition, you know, one of the things that happens is when we have challenging experiences like this, it not only impacts our physical and social and maybe emotional functioning, but it also impacts our spiritual functioning. And so when I sort of think about that, I think about what feeds my soul, who are the people that feed my soul, where are the places that feed my soul, and what are the activities that I do that feed my soul. And I think right now, more than anything, it's really especially important to connect to those people, to those places, and to those activities as much as possible.
Peter, thanks for calling. An email here from Dan. My daughter is 9 and biracial, and as is the case nationwide, African-American mental health counselors are not easily available. I am also worried for our Somalian community and mental health access. Where can I find African-American counselors here in Maine? Jenna.
Yeah, I completely agree that we have a significant shortage, but it's not just Maine. I mean, the reality is that information coming out from NAMI National, which is very much engaged in cultural competency around diversity of clinicians, says the same thing across the country. And so I do think that it is a critical issue we all need to be thinking about and working on. And you know, there are provider finders that it's kind of like Facebook for providers. Psychology Today operates one where you can both see pictures of people and read their bios in terms of finding a therapist that meets whatever specific needs you're looking for. But we also do need to think about, within the mental health field, how do we recruit more diverse populations to choose to become clinical social workers, professional counselors, psychologists, to ensure that we have providers that have a diversity of lived experiences that can support a wide array of individuals. It's definitely a challenge. There are resources to work to identify people that are in Maine. And I will just say about, you know, the new Mainers community is definitely a community we're very concerned about, but recognizing that in some of their countries, some of the work we've done, you know, in some of their countries, mental health isn't even sort of given voice. And so helping folks to, in a way that is responsive to their own cultural identity, have permission to understand that mental health is something that can impact their well-being as well. It's definitely somewhere we have a lot of work to do as a state.
Here's a tweet from Mary to Marty. Marty was our caller, I think, 2 callers ago. I am not really a pet person, but my lazy cat in the bed has been more comforting than I could have imagined. Allegra, we've seen a boom in pet adoption since the beginning of COVID. How powerful can a pet's companionship be in a time like this?
Yeah, pets are incredibly powerful. And certainly before COVID hit, there was a lot of research around the benefits of having a pet, not just for our physical health, especially when thinking about dogs and sort of that we need to walk them every day, sometimes multiple times a day, but also just thinking about the benefit of having another heartbeat in the house or sort of in your space. The other thing about pets is that they're so intuitive and just, you know, I have a cat and somehow she just knows when I need her to jump up on the bed or I need her to just come and sort of meow at me. And dogs are very much like that as well. The other really positive thing is especially dogs are so in the moment. And so when we find ourselves in those places of anxiety and sort of really struggling with all of the things that we may feel like are out of our control and what we're worrying about, pets are so great at bringing us back to what's happening right now in this moment, and do I need to focus on all that other stuff that I may be worried about in the moment? And so there's great benefits to having a pet around.
All right, we'll go to Brooke, who's calling from Alton, New Hampshire. Hi, Brooke. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I'm calling today to seek advice about living in the same household with somebody who has clearly mentally been affected by COVID and maybe at a place where they're like rather dark and isn't a family member. So talking kind of selflessly and openly might not be as welcomed as if it were a family member. I'm just seeking advice for myself, someone who has dealt with anxiety in the past, not necessarily, like just trying to balance that, want to help that person, but also not wanting to bring yourself into that dark place as well.
Sure, lots of roommate situations where somebody might be worried about a roommate, but not a family member. Jenna, I'll let you start.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a lot there in terms of, is the individual recognizing what's happening? Are they willing to engage in any type of support? I know you said you were in New Hampshire, but in Maine, and they don't really care where you're from, but in Maine, the state-funded peer centers were doing online support groups. NAMI Maine has, and I'm sure NAMI New Hampshire does as well, online virtual mental health support groups. Are they willing to engage in even a support group? You know, other folks to talk about what's going on. Are they willing to kind of do that, or if they've decided they're just not going to engage and instead they're going to sort of dump their bucket on you, in which case, you know, there's some need for self-protection there. If you're not able to, someone's not willing to engage at all, nobody can make anybody address their own mental health stuff. It's got to be a choice that they make. And so if that's not a choice they're making, then making choices for yourself that take care of your own mental well-being might sound unkind, but the reality is that letting someone know you're there and you're willing to be helpful is that sometimes just saying that over and over again, I'm here if you want to talk about this or move forward with something, but not kind of joining them in the vat of oil of sort of the darkness of it all for your own well-being.
Such an important question. Allegra, is there anything you want to add?
I think the only thing that I would add is really just reiterating that last part around the benefits of asking somebody a couple of times. So oftentimes, especially for folks that struggle with mental health challenges, if we ask them a question once, like, you know, can I help you find support, or how are you doing, or do you want to try a strategy, that there's a lot of stuff that can come up around their own maybe feelings of shame or guilt or other feelings that they may be having related to their struggles. And so they may not answer as honestly as if you were to ask them again and then maybe again, and really giving them that full permission to respond however they're going to respond.
All right. Thanks so much for that question, Brooke. I really appreciate it. I'm going to go to, we're almost out of time, but this is a quick post on Facebook from Melanie. All of my frustration, worry, and stress during the pandemic revolves around my first grader in school. I'm trying not to stress out about the fall, and we still don't know what it will look like. Allegra, do you have just a few seconds of thoughts for Melanie?
Yeah, I think, first of all, just recognizing that it is so incredibly hard, and there's so many different thoughts around schools opening, not opening, or, you know, sort of partially opening and what that looks like. So I would say, you know, continuing to talk with your child, continuing to recognize and sort of look at what are their behaviors, are there things that are worrying me or worrying me more, and then and then really talking to them about it and letting them know, you know, sort of, I wonder if you're feeling sad, I wonder if you're feeling worried, I wonder if you have questions. And really letting them know that it's okay for them to come talk to you with any questions that they have.
Great.
Or how they're feeling, and that you can help support them in that.
Thank you. That's Allegra Hirschwright, a clinical social worker with Maine Behavioral Healthcare. Also with us for the hour, Jenna Maynard, executive director of NAMI. Nikki Shields ran the board. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.